You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum. Bob Odenkirk is coming on. It's an intro. God's sakes. I just blow your eardrums out. Sorry. Somebody left a comment once and they were like, yeah, I almost turned it off because I didn't see Bob, didn't see your guest. I mean, have you ever heard of an introduction? I guess I'm that boring, huh? I didn't want to see me for whatever. Ryan's not here again. So I'm doing this all by my lonesome, but he is doing editing, massive amounts of editing. The Bob Odenkirk one, which is coming up right now, was pretty fantastic. And it got long because I was just like, holy crap, it's such a great conversation. We talk about Chris Farley. We talk about, you know, because he wrote, Van Down by the River. He wrote or co-wrote, worked with Chris as well, that sketch, which is, to me, there's nobody funnier than Chris Farley, and that sketch is one of the funniest sketches I've ever seen. And we talk about that a lot. I think he enjoyed it. I was hoping he would, because you never know. He's like, we're talking about so much about the past. Well, I really, truly love Bob Odenkirk on this show. He was just so open and sweet, and we talked a lot about everything. He just seemed, you know what it is? He seemed interested in me, interested in my house, interested in life. I don't know one person who doesn't like Bob Odenkirk. He's been working his ass off his whole life. And, Saul obviously is, you know, or Breaking Bad was his big break being bad. And then, Better Call Saul, which is on now and, is getting better and better and better. And, I have a lot of catching up to do, to be honest with you. Sorry, Bob, if you're listening to this, but, anyway, I'm not going to get into anything else. I hope you guys are all well. I hope you subscribe to the podcast. If you're not, please support us. We all do this for free. Obviously, we're doing well. I pay people to help me with this. But so you just watching, listening, sending to your friends, getting them to subscribe, writing reviews, it just really helps in the scheme of things. So I thank you dearly for that. I started a series called The Kingdom. Pretty rad on Netflix. I subtitle it. My friend Harlan decided to overdub it in English, which I don't know how he does that. Drives me crazy. Movie called The Platform. I think it was on Netflix, maybe. Really good. I love my horror. And anyway, Camp Rosie, be on the lookout for it. It's coming out Halloween. We're going to be doing Camp Rosie. The links will come out soon. Tickets will sell out. It's 2 days at a summer camp for Halloween. Camp Rosie. And Patreons, thank you so much to all my Patreons. It's just incredible, the large amount of people, fans, friends now. It's a community that have joined Patreon to support the podcast. And we do all sorts of fun stuff. Just go to Patreon, the app, or patreon.com. There's so many perks. If you're a fan of the podcast, you could join, and you get messages from me when you join. And just a bunch of good stuff. You want to check that out. You get a bunch of extra bonus stuff. If I say a bunch of extra, jeez Louise. Something that good happened that I want to throw out there, because, you know, obviously there's a lot of bad, but there's a lot of good too. My grandfather passed away November 28th, my brother's birthday, on Thanksgiving. And, you know, he was my best friend. I loved Irv deeply, dearly. Everyone did. And, you know, it's really tough for my grandmother, and April 8th was would have been his 94th birthday. And it was tough for my grandma. She's quarantined. So, we're all quarantined if you're doing the right thing. And my cousin Jill, his granddaughter, Jill, my cousin, gave birth to a little boy and named him Jack Irving. And I just thought that was really cool. On Irv's birthday, that happens. And I just thought that was a damn good thing. Damn good thing. Stay tuned afterwards. I'm going to read a couple of letters from fans and what they think of the show. And I haven't even read some of them yet, but I do read them. And thank you for being you. Sound like Mr. Rogers. Let's get inside of Bob Odenkirk.
It's my point of view. You're listening to Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum.
Inside of You with Michael Rosenbaum was not recorded in front of a live studio audience.
So am I recording?
Everything's recording.
And he's recording?
Everything's in
recording. And that's recording over there?
Oh, yeah.
Ryan, you're good?
Everything's great.
Yeah. So anyway, you're looking around.
Yeah. You have so much memorabilia. I think it's pretty damn cool. I mean, like I said, I don't collect stuff. I don't keep anything.
Yeah. You were looking at my stuff beforehand and you said that.
One of the reasons I don't is literally because people like you exist. So I don't need to, because instead of me having all this stuff, you have it, and I can just somehow find my way to your place once in a while and sure. get to look at it and go, wow. I get to leave and you have to take care of it.
Do you not have one thing at your house, or do you have one thing that you're like, if I met this actor, if I worked with this guy, there's one thing I would just want something. One thing. What if it was Robert De Niro? Have you worked with De Niro?
No, I sat next to him at the Saturday Night Live 45th anniversary.
Did he know who you were?
No.
Did you say something to him?
I looked at him and he looked at me and then I didn't bother him.
Did he give you like the breath?
Yeah.
Like
he seemed in his own world. He was with his wife. I think I took her seat for my bit. And that's why we interacted a little
for your
a
bit.
Second.
You had
I had a line or something. I think it was during Eddie Murphy's thing. There was like a line I had.
And it was right next to Robert De Niro.
Yes, I was sitting next to him or his wife. Somebody had to move a seat so I could sit there for my bit so they could get me on camera. And then my seat was behind on the row, a little ways up on the same row as Bill O'Reilly. Jeez. And everybody was famous in that room. But
you say,
Bill O'Reilly, and I'm like, why is he here? What is he doing? What are you doing here?
He likes comedy.
Yeah, I'll bet.
You said something.
Don't you love right-wingers' attempts at comedy? It's always fucking great.
So now we're going to alienate.
Those guys on Fox News like Greg Gutfeld. Oh, my God. It's such a sweat to watch him try to be
funny. But
you
do watch it.
It's on, I don't go there. But when it's on, I'm like, oh, this guy's trying to be funny. And you get to sweat like crazy and think, oh, it's so hard.
That's what makes you happy, watching people struggle. But maybe his audience finds
him
hilarious.
About it. It's always an angry laugh. It's never a fun, sweet, or likable.
Your laugh or his?
His attempt at humor. And I agree that if somebody were to say, well, a lot of the comedy you did was pretty harsh stuff. You're right.
Right.
But there was more of a joy to it and a silliness and a lightness. But a lot of right-wingers, when they try to be funny, it's only angry. It's only just anger coming out and couched as, isn't this funny? We're making fun. And it's got such anger in it. And you can just see it. It's not hidden at all.
And you like that?
Well, I like how hard they have to work and how much... It's just watching someone strive so overtly, so clearly striving.
With not a care in the world, just going for it.
No, they are. They have tons of cares in the world. They can't relax at all because everything, oh, geez, I'm overanalyzing it to you, maybe, but comedy people would know. I think writers would know exactly what I mean. Like,
what right wingers would you say? Now, we're going to alienate a lot of people.
I'm just saying,
what right-wingers do you think are really...
I don't want to make this too political, because I don't really...
I don't get political. I just want to know who's funny. Like, who's a real conservative, who's a friend of yours, who's a, you know, a very conservative, who is funny.
Isn't Norm Macdonald kind of conservative?
I
think he's really funny.
He's brilliant.
He's one of the funniest guys ever. I always thought Nick DiPaolo was pretty damn funny.
Who's Nick DiPaolo? I should know that.
He's a comic, a New York comic.
Very conservative.
And he is very conservative.
But you find him funny.
He can be damn funny. Yeah.
You said something in an interview that you were like, famous people still make you nervous. I don't know if you're kidding around, because I kind of have that feeling. I get that feeling. So I connect. When I see something in an interview like that, this little nuance of like, yeah, I get nervous. Do you really get nervous around big stars?
I've refined my sense of my own anxiety a little bit. Because some people, like, I think it has more to do with their kind of like the way they approach the world and who you think you're interacting with. If you think the person is on the same wavelength as you, then no. So like, I did a movie called The Post, and I was very, very awkward around Steven, who's such a nice person, Steven Spielberg, who directed it. And
is that the one with Meryl Streep?
And yeah.
Right.
And also Tom Hanks, who I've known for a long, long time.
And you're nervous around them.
Extremely nervous.
Did they know that?
I think they could sense it, sure.
What is it about? How would you describe yourself if somebody was watching you? What
happens? I honestly read something today that gave me clarity on it. And it said something. Ooh, I even wrote it down.
Please share it.
It was a line from something in an article. You don't recruit Spielberg if you aren't looking for a product with heart, one that has optimism instead of cynicism at its core. And that's true.
Right.
And I think I have cynicism at my core. And so when I'm around people who don't see the world that way, it's hard. I get more nervous. I don't feel like I can relax and just say anything and they'll understand the layer of cynical critique that is just a part of how I look at the world. And then I have to be very careful around them. It's like being around an aunt and an uncle at a wedding and they go, "What? Tell me about this Breaking Bad." And you go like, "Well, yeah, you, it's not really for you, but you know, there's a lot of violence and you know, you don't really, I'm not going to just relax and tell you what I'm thinking because you're a nice person. You live in a nice world. The world you see is a nice place with good people, with good intentions. And that's not how I see the world.
Okay,
and I don't want to wreck you. I'm happy that you exist. And I am not trying to dissuade you or teach you anything.
Right.
God bless you for seeing things that way. We need people like you more than we need people like me. And I don't want to, you know what I mean?
Does this go through your head every time?
I think it's just that feeling of, and so when I, the last day, that the whole crew on that film was together. It was a wonderful moment where Steven Spielberg thanked us all and told us how great we were. And then we went to a restaurant where everybody was talking and enjoying the experience we just had. And I got to hang out with Meryl and I had a great time and totally relaxed and just laughing. And
were you upset with yourself?
Because she's cynical. And so, like, I connected. Like, I was right. Yeah, like, I knew, like, oh, I mean, obviously, I should be intimidated by her massive talent and resume and just who she is.
Right.
But way less because I could say anything and not feel like she might not understand the point of view that I'm talking from.
Right.
It might hurt her feelings even to hear rude or harsh comment. It wouldn't.
No.
She's really a sharp, kind of harsh person.
I mean, whatever, she was very close friends with Carrie Fisher, and so that
you feel those things right away, and you can relax with a person.
So you felt comfortable.
I don't think it has to do with fame. Is my point. I think the nervousness comes about a feeling of like we're not on the same wavelength. And I'm not trying to teach anybody anything. I'm fine with talking to people who understand what I'm saying. And then, you know, I'm not trying to lecture people or
so fame doesn't get in the way. When Spielberg walks in a room, you're not going.
It does. Come on, that guy's so huge that he's like an icon. And when he talks to you, it's like Abraham Lincoln jumping off the penny and talking. And you're like, what are you talking to me for? You should be in a history book. I can't look at you.
How do you act? Take
that
one.
That just was freaking me out. But that was, everybody was freaked out by that.
But
everybody,
take one for Odenkirk. Take one.
Horrible.
You're seen.
Just
you're,
the worst.
Spielberg's watching you. He's behind the camera.
You forget how to walk.
Who are you acting with?
Now you
with?
Tell me.
Who are you acting with?
No, but you have to tell me a story about being intimidated.
Always.
Go.
My story of my life. Even like
I want to hear about Clint Eastwood.
Well, I had met you years ago. And I hadn't seen you so long. You've had all this fame and all this, you know, and I love it because you're one of the good guys. And you walk in. I was a little nervous. I was like, oh, you know, and then you have an innate ability to sort of make people feel comfortable, which I also, I'm not to brag, but I have a gift like that. I like to make people feel good, comfortable. You immediately go in my office. You're like, wow, you have all this signed shit. I wouldn't get it, but I understand why you do.
Yeah.
And it's just like there's a rapport. You make people feel comfortable.
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Well, it's true. It is.
Well, I think part of that is, you know, if you get some great roles as you've had and I've had and you get attention, you kind of ask yourself, like, how much of this should I own and should I make a part of myself? Like the attention you're feeding me and the focus I deserve and I should, you know, and some people feel incredibly justified. And in fact, I think feel like they finally found their place in the world when they get all that focus and attention. And then they carry that with them wherever they go, right?
Yeah.
And then I think people like me, and I would say probably you, feel like, well, no, wait, I'm just a regular person. I'm getting attention because of the project I'm in right now, whatever that is, a movie, we're on a promotional tour, or someone's a fan of the project. They don't know me.
Right.
They're not a fan of me. They will never know me. My wife knows me and my kids kind of know me. And then that's about it. And everyone else who thinks I'm great or wants to talk to me or give me their focus, they're fans of the project that I'm in, not me. And so I'm okay. I'm just the working person who's in that project. And it's nice to get that reflected attention and focus. It is nice.
That's interesting,
by
the way.
Isn't it nice, by the way?
It is. But, you know, there's a difference. I think, you know, I want to get into this, but like there's, I've used this example before, but there's a difference between like getting attention, people telling you you're great, and how you fill up. It feels like it's like what equivalent to what love is, right? But love is sustainable, and then the attention isn't, right? It keeps coming in and out like a
comet. Yeah, it comes and goes, right?
So if you're banking all on that, my therapist said,
that's because it's not about you, it's about your projects. And when your projects recede in time, as they all will and do, then you lose some of that focus, and you're like, where is it? Where is it? Oh, it was never for you. It was for the project.
Right.
Go make another one. And if it's good, you'll also see more of that stuff. Yeah.
Did you ever get caught up in like,
I think I was too old to get caught up.
For the big success.
Yes.
Because you really had like, I look around.
I told my kids when they were around 8 or 9, I remember saying to my daughter, I have the perfect amount of fame. Because occasionally a person, a Mr. Show fan usually, would see me and get smiley and ask for my autograph and just tell me how much they love my work. And it was like, not every day, but depends where I was.
Right. Jerry's Deli, Studio City.
You know, somebody would, come out of the woodwork, and it was just really fun. And I could even say that, if you took a room full of people, I could go, that person knows me and that person knows me. And they have tattoos.
They have a
Mr. Show tattoo on their neck. But you know, you just know, and that's it. Now with Breaking Bad and all that stuff, then that was another level. And I can see how it would mess up a young person, right? If you were 26 and you were in a show that big, you would.
I was 26 in Smallville. Hit.
Tell me about it.
You hear the doorbell? Bob, do you hear the doorbell?
Yeah, that's all right. Doorbells are okay on podcasts.
So tell me about what my success or how it happened.
Being young and having that experience. Because as an older person, you've seen friends go through it. I was a writer at Saturday Night Live. And weirdly, this is such a the self-hating, cynical part of me. Whenever I'd see a friend, an acquaintance have like massive fame, it would not so much make me think, oh, my friend has achieved something great. It would make me think, oh, anybody can be famous now. Because if they know me and I know them and they're famous, then it's nothing.
It just doesn't make sense.
And
you
that's dumb.
You said something a little while ago, and I feel like I've just never felt like I belong necessarily. Like I know I've had fame. I know I've had some great roles. I know that I've done well. But there's part of me that like a lot of times I just don't feel. I feel like I'm still that kid from Indiana who's just trying to make everybody laugh.
Where are you from in Indiana?
Southern Indiana. I know you went to SIU. My buddy Ethan said go Salukis.
Yeah.
So he went there. So I got to throw Ethan.
Yeah, and I know Indiana a little bit because my cousins lived in Indianapolis, and now my brother Phil lives in Indianapolis.
And where'd you grow up?
Naperville, Illinois. Mostly Naperville, yeah. Mm-hmm. But I would occasionally go down to Indianapolis and even to Southern. I went once, I don't even remember who, but I was like in high school, and a friend of mine was like, we're going down to my uncle's pig farm in Southern Illinois. is it Bloomington?
Bloomington, Indiana.
Bloomington, Indiana, I mean.
Yeah.
And we went there and spent the weekend. Bloomington is nice. Farm. Yeah.
They got the Little Five, right?
I don't know the Little Five.
Indiana University is in Bloomington. They got the Little 500, the bike race.
Do they have a farm hockey team?
I'm sure they do.
The city had a farm league hockey team, professional farm league, you know, AAA or something.
Sure wasn't Columbus, Indiana?
It might have been Columbus.
Indiana.
And I went to see the game. It was great. Anyway.
So Indiana is where I grew up. But
yeah, great. I love that part of the country. And I love that strip of weather and all down there.
Yeah, the seasons,
Carbondale.
Man.
It's fucking great.
Yeah, Carbondale. I played hockey in Carbondale.
A little bit of snow, but not. It just melts the next day.
Do you have good memories of growing up, like in the Midwest? Midwest, right, is where you grew up.
Yeah. It's very mixed, but yeah, pretty good, I'd say.
I mean,
my dad wasn't a piece of shit, I would have
really?
That would have been great.
Because I read about that, and you always
He wasn't. He didn't beat us, so that's good. And
but he beat you with his words?
Nah, he was just remote and fucked up and not around, and the tension and... The tension emanating from that relationship and that his what was missing, you know, it seeped through everything in our lives. And we had a great, I love my brothers and sisters, and we got along great, and we loved each other and supported each other and laughed a lot and still do, still are very close. And I'm from a family of seven kids. But the tension coming out of that feeling of like, what the hell is going on?
Was it argumentative with your mother?
It was money. And it was also just, he wasn't around. I have seven, there's seven kids in the family.
So your mom just took care of seven of you and you guys took care of each other?
Yeah, yeah. But like, how do you even have seven kids? You have to show up seven times. There have to be at least seven nights.
Seven moments. Unless there's twins, six.
But outside of those seven visits, I don't know how much, you know, the guy was not to be seen.
You don't remember him playing ball with you? You remember those things?
Not much. Yeah. He gave me some advice once or twice that was.
What was the advice?
Crying doesn't change anything.
Is that what he said?
And I remember looking at him, goes crying, and I went, oh, he's right.
Do you cry much?
Nothing's changed. No. But
is it because of that?
More. Oh, no. No, I think it's just from just being a guy and. but I think getting older, you do a little bit more.
What happened to me in the last 2 years? I'm like,
really?
I get emotional. I mean, I don't know what it is, but it feels good. It feels good when you're alone to let out a cry.
It does. It feels good to be emotional, to feel like you have access to your emotions.
When's the last time you got emotional?
Oh, man. I'd have to think about it for longer than the podcast wants to wait. But it wasn't that long ago. I mean,
A breakdown alone or with the wife?
No.
The Rolling Stone Music Now podcast gets inside the biggest stories with Rolling Stone senior writer Brian Hyatt.
Now here is my conversation with Jacob Knoll. Your story is an amazing one, and obviously you lost your dad when you're only 1 year old.
It was definitely a screwy way to grow up. I think that a lot of people never heard of who I am, and then they see me join this band, and they must think this kid must have just been handed everything, or nepotism kid. It's a gift that I have an opportunity to sing in such a big band like my father and my uncle's band, Sublime.
Rolling Stone Music Now, wherever you listen.